Welcome to Carbro Bookbeat. This is the program that features reviews and interviews devoted to the literary life of Carbro and the Greater Triangle Area. Your hosts are Paul Maj and Audrey Layden, that's me, on the airwaves at 103.5 FM, as well as webcast live, courtesy of iBiblio, on WCOMFM.org. To find out about our exciting schedule of guests and to access show archives and podcasts, go to www.carbrobookbeat.com. Okay, we have our guest is Susie Burriel is just coming into the studio now. Oh, glad to see you, Susie. Thanks for getting here. Susie spent 25 years as a newspaper reporter and editor before becoming a teacher of English and journalism at Wake Tech Community College in Raleigh. In 2001, she won the Paul Green Multimedia Award from the North Carolina Society of Historians, and she is currently co-editor of the papers of Richard Caswell for the North Carolina Office of Archives and History. And on top of that, she is the great-great-granddaughter of Ellie Swain, who was the
subject of our book.
The subject of the book, Undaunted Heart, and she was the Southern Belle who married the Yankee general, also daughter of the president of UNC.
Yes, and not only that, but I think it probably foretold the wayward ways of Chapel Hill always being a little out of step with the rest of the state. In some ways...
Welcome, Susie.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to see you here.
Thank you. I'm sorry I'm late.
Wrong building. Oh, dear. Tell me how you pronounce your last name.
Burrilli.
Burrilli. Okay. I was saying Burrilli, and I thought, I don't think that's right. Burrilli. Okay. Well, you had a little trouble finding the place? Or?
Just a block too far down. So.
Oh.
I was sitting and waiting.
Oh.
It's okay.
Uh-huh. But did I not give you the right directions?
No, I looked at the address on the bottom of the email.
You looked at the mailing address instead of the station address. You got to be clear about that in your email.
Well, it's just the... Oh, anyway.
It's okay. Just for the record, I was early.
Oh, dear.
It's okay. It's all right.
All right. Well,
I'm glad you got here.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, too.
We've had really enjoyed, as I was reading Undaunted Heart, the true story of a Southern Belle and a Yankee general, I was thinking, this is the way history should be written. If it was written this way, you wouldn't have so many, particularly high school students, who hate history. I mean, I have heard it from so many kids, my own in general, in particular, and myself as I was going through high school.
Too many dates and places and names to remember and memorize.
Oh, yeah, there was nothing personal about it.
Mm-hmm.
I need more personal story.
When I had one teacher who talked about English history and started telling us stories about Henry VIII and personalizing everything, it was... Oh, okay.
Yeah, when you start to learn a little bit about the people, it makes it more personal to you, I think.
Right, and you pick up more. Otherwise, it's taught like math is taught. I mean, it's very cold and dry.
Yeah.
To me. I mean, to a mathematician, maybe it's not.
I gave extra credits to my students to come to a reading last week, and then during the week, during classes... They were saying, oh, gosh, I didn't know history could be like this. So you're right.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a better way to learn it, I think.
Uh-huh.
Well, I remember once getting the one-upmanship on my high school professor when I pointed out to him that the opium wars that the Americans were fighting so they could sell the Chinese opium. And he was trying to let us slip it in there that we were fighting against the opium being sold.
Oh.
So that little bit of strange revisionism, I caught him on.
Well, it's interesting in writing something that is part of your family history. And one of the questions that I had for you, and we don't have to stick with them, but this one was, you probably heard a lot of these stories as you were growing up.
Well, I heard some of the stories. As I think back on it, I'm not exactly sure why we didn't hear all of the stories. Mm-hmm. I don't think that my great-grandmother wanted to talk about it, and she is Ella and General's daughter.
Right.
I don't have but a couple pictures of her that she's smiling in. So I'm not sure.
This is
their daughter, Ella and General's daughter, yeah. And my great grandmother. I don't know whether she missed her mother so much that she was just a sad young woman. I'm mm-hmm. just not really sure what. But as people have asked me this question about all the stories I heard, and I can say, I only heard a couple of stories growing up. Uh-huh. And then, so why? And yeah. And all I can figure is that I'm not so sure that she had a very happy life, and she mm-hmm. didn't talk about her life much. These mm-hmm. letters were tucked away in a cardboard folder.
Wow.
And I did not see them, and I don't think my mother ever saw them, because my great uncle had them, and when he died, they came in a box to me.
Uh-huh.
So first they went to my mother, and then she had them, and then they came to me with a note that they were supposed to go to me. And that's when I learned what Ella Swain and General Atkins' life was like once they were married. The two stories I heard growing up were that Mrs. Swain refused to sit at the dinner table with her son-in-law, and so he would take her dinner tray up to her and sit with her, whether she was visiting them in Illinois or whether they were visiting her in North Carolina. He would take the dinner tray up to her and sit with her. So clearly there was some conversation that took place. And then I heard the story about General Atkins and President Swain being hung in effigy from the bell tower while the wedding was taking place, and small things like that, but nothing that really told of that life together.
That was intimate and detailed. No. And it seemed from reading this that they had a very happy relationship.
I think that they did. Uh-huh. I think he loved her very much, and uh-huh. I think she loved him very much, and I think that that's clear in any of the pieces of writing that we have from either him to her or her about him.
So I imagine that, you know, the second part of that was, did your research bring you any surprises? And it probably did, because you didn't have that much of a deep background to it.
You're right. I didn't have that much of a deep background. And so the surprises were, well, I didn't know that they had six children, that she had lost three of her children. I didn't know that they had a son who died. Mm-hmm. I didn't know all my cousins that I came upon as I went through this research, which has been extremely fun. Uh-huh. I'm going up to Washington, D.C. next weekend to meet one who lives in California who's also named Eleanor, because down both sides of the family, Ella's side of the family and her brother's side of the family, the girls were named Eleanor.
Uh-huh.
So that's been a lot of fun in terms of finding and meeting new family. And then just learning the stories of their life and the aha moments when you start putting it all together for what you find.
Have your cousins appreciate the book as well?
Well, yes, because they always heard, at least the ones on Ella's brother's side of the family, always heard that the family had disowned her.
Uh-huh.
And I said, no, that's not what happened.
Right.
And I also found letters about their ancestor in this packet of letters that gave them a little more insight to their family history as well.
Well, so that's great.
Yes, that was a rewarding part of doing the research, I think.
Yeah, folks, what we're talking about is Undaunted Heart, a true story of a Southern Belle and a Yankee general. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Southern Belle. What was her name?
Her name was Eleanor Hope Swain, and she married Atkins. Her family called her Ella, but growing up, we called her Ellie, because not until I read her letters and then actually got out the jewelry that got passed down and read the inscription on the back and looked at the family Bible and read the inscription, did I discover that she was called Ella by her family. So I'm not saying she never was called Ellie, because the name Eleanor has different nicknames that go with it, and so probably she was called Ellie by some. But she referred to herself as Ella and signed her letters that way.
Well, it's really fascinating is that this, first of all, she's the daughter of the president of the university system.
And that's a university here in Chapel Hill, folks.
Yes, right here in Chapel Hill. And right at the close of the Civil War, she has this great romance with a Yankee general.
The General Smith D. Atkins was the leader of the soldiers who were sent to Chapel Hill by General Sherman to protect the university and make sure that it was that nothing happened to it, that nothing was stolen, nothing was burned. He called on David Swain, the president, to say we're here, as if it wasn't clear enough by all these soldiers and horses and accoutrements of battle that they had with them. And he had to introduce his daughter to this general because of
the mother was
he called. He wanted to show General Atkins a book that he that he had, so he called for somebody to bring it. Ella was the one who brought it, and thus he was forced to introduce her. Cornelia Phillips Spencer, who chronicled everything going on in Chapel Hill during the war, said their eyes met and a wooing followed. So
I mean that's what's in the book, and it seems like it was particularly for him. An instant lightning bolt or something.
2 days later, he had written her a poem.
Yeah. Whether he was just a general flirt or not is
hard to tell. His friend, who was with an Ohio cavalry that was also with this group of soldiers, said that he was a bachelor who had always intended to remain one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was nearly 30 years old.
That's pretty old, yeah.
But she was not one to be trifled with.
No, she seemed to have a spirit about her that was
going
to...
She's a bold little thing herself.
Well, no, she was a young teenager then, right?
She was 22.
She was 22? All right.
She heard her... You know, the war had started when she was 18. And so the years when young women would have been meeting young men and getting married were passing by because this war was going on and all the young men were off to war.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So she met this dashing general coming in, who's, you know, coming in with all wrapped in glory and power, even though he was on the other side.
And, you know, when the Southern troops came through on Good Friday before Ella met General Atkins on Easter Monday, the girls flirted with them and fed them and gave them flowers and all. Then they left. Next round of soldiers comes through, and the same happened. According to Mrs. Spencer, they welcomed the Yankee soldiers just as they had welcomed home the Southern soldiers.
Yeah, it sounded like that. This was not the only romance that was going on between the Southern womanhood and the Yankee visitors.
No, and research shows that it happened all over.
Right.
In the North and the South throughout
One of the questions is that one of the things that comes up is the sort of institutionalized bitterness. This must have grown post-site for a while. How do you see that developing?
Well, I think that one of the reasons the bitterness continued was once the war was over, the United States of America was ready to take the Southern states back into the fold, but there were going to be some rules. And the Southerners didn't necessarily like the rules that were placed on them. Reconstruction, it was difficult. Yeah. Suddenly they didn't have slaves. They had servants who had to be paid. People who supported the U.S. government were being put into power. Those who had been a little hesitant were not being put into power. The faculty and President Swain were asked to resign their positions. They had offered a year before to resign and their resignation because the university was in such financial trouble, and they had all offered to resign, and they had been told by their Confederate government no. But when the Reconstruction government came in and took over, they accepted the resignations a year later. And this created problems as well, because now here were people out of jobs.
Yeah.
And the enrollment at that time at
the enrollment had dropped.
Very small.
There were probably a dozen or so young men by the time that the war had ended. And remember, back in those days, young men went to college as early as 14 and 15. And so they weren't always old enough to fight, or mom and dad weren't going to let them go fight. So there were few young men on the campus. There were only two or three faculty members left, and it was a difficult time. There were no men left
to
come back.
Start with.
Well, yes, except because UNC is the oldest state university, its reputation was outstanding up and down the East Coast. David Swain and General Sherman had something in common when they met near Clayton for the surrender of the state, because General Sherman had been the superintendent at the Louisiana military school. And some of those young men had come here either before or after. So David Swain and General Sherman had something in common. They knew the same young men.
Well, when you look at it, and I'm really not a student of the Civil War or of history in general, but from what I have read, there are a lot of ties between Lee and Sherman. I mean, the interconnectedness of the people involved in this war is deep and very varied.
Well, up until the war, they had all been...
Went to the same schools.
Right, exactly.
They intermarried. There was a lot of closeness.
And there were young men who some fought on the... who were brothers, who some fought for the North and some fought for the South. So there was a lot of that. And so before the war, people were friends. They were comrades. They were professional colleagues.
Right.
And so after the war... What do we do?
Yeah. So, but it seemed that with when the general came and met with David Swain, it seemed like they really had a rapport.
David Swain had not favored secession until it became inevitable that it would happen. And so I think that when the war was over, his feeling was, okay, it's time for us to all come back together again. Now, his wife didn't necessarily agree with him, but that was okay. And so he was ready to sit down and talk. And because they were both history buffs, they had something in common that they could talk about.
Yeah. It's just, it's a fascinating story. And one of the other things in looking at the amount of research that you've done, I mean, your bibliography goes on for pages back here. I mean, how long did it take you to do all this?
Oh, gosh. Well, I found the letters back in the early 90s, and I started using them as background for papers I wrote in graduate school. I even wrote one called The Rhetoric of Love. I'm sure it was very boring, but but at the time it sounded like a good idea, because here were these letters, and what could I do with them?
Right.
And I was a newspaper reporter at the time, so I wrote several different stories about the couple, and I used the letters as the basis for it. And then I started shopping around to see who would be interested in more of this story. I wound up writing a piece for the Chapel Hill Historical Society for its 2000 calendar. And then I was invited over in February of 2000 to do a program at the Historical Society about them. So that was the first presentation that I did after finding the letters in 92. The first presentation I did about the couple and told the whole story. And so from there, I spent the next several years going around speaking to different groups. I had a slides and artifacts that I would take with me. And in 2007, let's see, where are we? We're in 2009. In 2007, I spent part of the summer writing the book, what I had finally decided was the book. And I thought it was done. And I announced to all my colleagues when I got back to Wake Tech in the fall, I finished my book, and they all applauded and hooray. And then I set it down because the semester began and life got crazy, and I started looking at it again in the spring, thinking, I'm not so sure that this is done. So spring of 2008, I'm not so sure that this is done, but I thought, okay, maybe time to look for a publisher, and I started looking around.
Your publisher is Eno.
It is Eno Publishers
right
out of Hillsboro, yes.
And they're fairly new, aren't they?
Elizabeth Woodman has a lot of publishing experience background, but this is a brand new publishing house, and I'm her second book.
We had her first book on, actually, The Rain Gardening in the South.
Oh, I missed that. Yeah, I wasn't around for that one. Yeah.
So UNC Press recommended Eno Publishers, and off we were running with it in August of 2008. So it took a couple of years, and I tell people that Elizabeth had brought new eyes to the story. You know, after you've looked at something for so long, you don't see any flaws. You don't see anything missing. You think all the questions have been answered. And so I like to say that she took it and tossed it up in the air like 52-card pickup, and then we put it back together again. I had written it chronologically. She helped put it in a chronological thematic format.
Okay.
so that it's still chronological, but it's also broken up into themes.
Right.
And I think that what she did for this story has made it. Oh,
yeah.
Yes,
right.
It makes it a much stronger narrative.
Yeah.
A nice addition is are the photos, and they're a handsome couple.
They are a handsome couple, aren't they? Now, the photo of her on the cover, when people look at it, she was either 14 or 15 in that photo.
Uh-huh.
And the one of General Atkins clearly is when he was at least 27,
right?
Because that's how old he was when he enlisted. We have many, many, many photographs of him and few photos of her. There are probably three altogether of her.
And I wouldn't be able to guess her age from this, but I'm not a good guess of age anyway. But it's, she looks like she could be 16 or 17.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe not 22.
Probably not 22.
Right.
So, yeah, so the photos that we have of her, the one of her is a young woman on the cover, then mm-hmm. the one inside of her in her late 30s, shortly before her death.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have another of her when she was quite younger, a portrait of her.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all the photographs that we have of her.
Yeah. Well, it's really a great, particularly for someone who is familiar with this area, because it's, wow, this was an exciting thing.
Yes, it happened right here.
Time.
So imagine you lived on Franklin Street,
and
Mrs. Spencer said that as the wedding party went past, people closed their shutters, and
uh-huh.
so right there on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill,
right.
people pulling their shutters closed and not wanting to acknowledge what was going on, and they had to go through town because the railroad had not yet come to Chapel
uh-huh.
Hill. So in order for them to leave to move to Illinois,
mm-hmm.
where General Atkins was from, and which was the norm in those days, young women moved to where their husbands were from,
right.
They had to take a buggy ride over to Raleigh.
Uh-huh.
And so they had to go down Franklin Street in order to head out the
right.
Raleigh Road.
You mentioned, of course, that you were a reporter and editor for a good number of years.
Long time, yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to think it was that long, but
yeah.
I graduated from the UNC Journalism School
uh-huh.
And went into newspapers, worked primarily in papers, worked a little bit in public relations and
uh-huh.
public information, but primarily in newspapers my career.
Were there newspapers in the Carolinas or...?
I worked at the Henderson Daily Dispatch.
Okay.
I worked at the Cary News.
Oh, all right.
I lived in Frederick, Maryland for a while and worked at the newspaper up there and
uh-huh.
worked at a small paper that's no longer in existence, but a small weekly in Kernersville
uh-huh.
for a while. So, yeah, in North Carolina.
Right.
I've written for Triangle Business Journal and
mm-hmm.
have had things appear in the News Observer.
And is this your first regular full-length book?
This is my first regular full-length book,
uh-huh.
and whether it will be my first and last, I'm not sure. A cousin who I discovered in the process, descended from the Swain son,
uh-huh.
and I are working on editing the papers of Richard Caswell, who was the state's first governor following the Declaration of Independence. So he
was
our Revolutionary War governor.
Who was that person?
He was our Revolutionary War governor, and he was also a commander of Revolutionary War forces. But his papers have never been collected.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, when a governor goes out of office, the papers are collected and the pertinent ones are published in volumes, and his have not been done.
Mm-hmm.
So because
a lot
we're
of archival
both
work,
it is. I spent 3 hours at archives going through not a full microfilm reel.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to figure out which letters I needed to photocopy, and then we have to transcribe them. So it is a long process and a tedious process to decide which ones are important and which ones are not,
yeah.
and getting them transcribed and making certain that you've read the handwriting correctly. And because although
this is the real work of historians, folks.
Yes. Yeah,
yeah, penmanship was a little easier to read back then, I think. Different letters were not made the same as
right,
we make them
like
today. So.
Yeah. Fs, I mean, Ss
yes.
look like Fs,
yes.
and so on and so forth. But it's true about penmanship. I mean, when I see, copies of letters that were written in the 1700s and 1800s, and I think, my goodness.
There was more of a formula to follow.
How schooled they mm-hmm. all seem to be, and their wording seemed so formal in the letters
mm-hmm.
and in comparison to what I've been familiar with in my lifetime.
Well, the language has changed a great deal
uh-huh.
As we've switched since after World War II. an orality in our terms that we're becoming more and more, moving more and more to an oral culture, which allows for more fluidity in grammar.
Oh, yes. And my lit students at Wake Tech, I teach an early American literature class, and so we start with Columbus and we work our way to 1865. And I keep telling them, it will get easier. It will get easier as they're reading this language that they're not familiar with.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting because it's the daily life. I mean, this is the language not necessarily of the presidents and the higher ups. This is the way ordinary soldiers would write letters
right.
home,
mm-hmm.
and that makes a difference because, like, when I first heard Shakespeare, I had no problem in understanding it. It was just the way it was put out. And fell in love with it and understood that this was stagecraft, this was playwriting. This is not necessarily the way individuals communicate
right.
with one another.
Thank goodness. Yeah. Well, maybe not.
Well, I don't know. But
some of Alice's letters were hard because of little punctuation.
Uh-huh.
And so trying to read the letters and figure out where the sentences began and end was sometimes tricky. And she used a lot of abbreviations as well because she didn't have a formal education.
Right.
She, when young women back in those days, when they were going to school, they weren't learning reading, writing, and arithmetic. They were learning
sewing
and how to be a good wife and how to converse with your husband and how to cook and how to do a little bit of artwork. And
they, when you went to school, you learned how to converse with your husband?
One of the goals at St. Mary's School, where she attended for a while, was that the women would be able to be good conversationalists with their husbands and be knowledgeable about some different topics,
uh-huh.
but not that they would be schooled in the
topics. Because they wouldn't want to be in a place where they might be some competition for a husband.
Right. And there's very little mention of anything other than being a wife and mother in Ella's letters to her parents.
Right.
There's only one instance where she mentions anything about politics, and it's simply a off the cuff, you know, this man's been good to my husband, and that was it.
But you think that perhaps the work you're doing on the papers of Richard Caswell might lead to another book?
I don't know.
Who knows what's out there?
Yeah. Who knows what's out
but,
there?
Well, it's definitely something that probably deserves to be published, in whatever form, just for the documentation that it needs.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if you found anything in his papers that have the kind of drama that this presents. I mean, this is kind of dramatic.
It is dramatic. He had lots of opinions. General Atkins was an opinionated man,
mm-hmm.
and perhaps that explains how he was a leader during the war and how he continued to be a leader in his hometown when the war was over and called upon as a speaker at rallies and whatnot because he did have a drive. And maybe that's why he thought he'd always be a bachelor because he had this drive and he had these things he wanted to accomplish. And so he was this leader, and most of his writings are opinion, so to speak, scribbled in the margins of some of the books about the war that were written after the war are his thoughts
comments,
on this isn't true, this didn't happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
And
interesting.
But then again, a few comments about slavery, how horrible it was, a couple comments about different battles that they fought in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of writing and speeches, long speeches, telling about how wonderful the nation is and how we should be grateful for what we have and honoring one another. Just very formal speech at that point, formal speaking at that point. But I don't know that there's anything worth turning into a sequel to this.
Well, I was thinking in terms of Richard Caswell, does he have any drama in his life?
Richard Caswell had
run
drama.
Off with a gypsy or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, no.
No.
Okay. And not that he wasn't a a good person to write about. There have been books written about him, uh-huh. about his life as a statesman, and about his life as a soldier, and about his life as a civil servant. Mm-hmm. And Keith Sparrow edited a wonderful book about him, I guess, 2 summers ago during the celebration of his service and his birth. But there aren't a lot of papers that are much more than letters that he wrote while he was either mm-hmm. a soldier or while he was a governor, pardoning people, giving land to people, collecting taxes from people. Those are the kind of documents that we have Richard Caswell's.
You don't have any family-type things from him?
No.
He was married and had children?
He was married twice. He had children. Uh-huh. In fact, Mrs. Swain was his granddaughter. She was uh-huh. his daughter's daughter. But there just isn't a whole lot. In fact, right. poor Richard Caswell, we're not sure where he's buried.
Uh-huh.
There have been lots of attempts to find the exact burial place, but even an excavation that was held a couple summers ago didn't reveal anything. So he's very much a mystery man in a way, mm-hmm. because we don't have a lot of what belonged to him.
Right.
And I don't know that we're going to uncover any. There are lots of Caswell historians out there.
Uh-huh. Is there a Caswell County, isn't there?
There is a Caswell County. There's right. a museum in Kinston. Uh-huh. So there are lots of people who have looked at his life, and there's just not a lot to go on.
It makes me ask, were you always interested in history, or is it something because you have such an interesting history in your background that drew you to it?
That was actually one question. You spoke about your great-grandmother. Did you ever meet her? Was she ever alive when you...
No, she died before I was born. Her husband yeah. mm-hmm. died when I was a year old. So I don't know. I never had any conversations with them. My grandmother, their daughter, would talk about it a little bit, but again, not a whole lot. Only the stories, you know, the ring that was to be passed down, the mm-hmm. here's a portrait of them. We have a piece of glass that Ella etched her name into, and then her daughter etched her name underneath mm-hmm. it, but which gives you some look into what their relationship was like. And, you know, when you're young, you don't ask the important people those questions
right, right.
that you want to know later.
Yeah.
Right. So my grandparents died in 1970. My mother died in 1991. My great uncle, who was the family historian, died in 1984. I had a young child at the time. Mm-hmm. I didn't have time to ask those kinds
right.
of questions.
Right.
And then when the time came to want the answers, there was nobody
yeah.
left to answer them.
Well, one of the
that's
reasons-
a point for all our listeners to think of right now.
Ask those questions,
ask the questions now.
Yeah,
yes.
one of the reasons why it was when Sputnik went up. And I'm a grammar school kid, and I had a pretty elderly school teacher at the time, and I asked her, and she remembered her father witnessing the Lincoln train. This is the train mm-hmm. that carried his body throughout mm-hmm. a good portion of the, and you know, and standing there watching that, and I thought, gee whiz, the Civil War, you know, or something. And she, you know, yeah. that's how close it was.
Right,
right.
Yes.
And of course, it's not quite as close anymore, folks.
No, it gets farther and farther away.
It does.
When I talk to younger people, like in the early 20s or something, and the 50s were farther away. I mean, that's when I was going through my teenagery.
Yeah.
And it's, oh my goodness.
And we have so much to put in our history books now that when we reference different periods of history in the United States, it gets smaller and smaller
yeah.
what's in the history books, because
that's true, yeah.
you're either going to make the textbooks bigger, you're going to have multi-volumes of textbooks, or you're simply going to not cover as much
right.
about
and,
them.
So
yeah.
what was your approach to history when you were in high school?
Well, both my parents were journalism majors. They met here at UNC. Actually, my dad was from New York, and mm-hmm. my mother was born in Florida. So again, we have
uh-huh.
the Yankee Southern Belle
uh-huh.
love story. And my dad wound up going into the Navy. He was an ROTC student and wound up going into the Navy. And so we didn't move as much as a lot of Navy families did in terms of going overseas. But wherever we lived, my parents always made certain that we that we took trips. We went camping. We mm-hmm. went to see this. We went mm-hmm. to see that. And so ever since I was little, knowing about where I was and right. knowing its history was just a part of growing up.
Okay.
We drove cross country when my dad was transferred from Norfolk to San Diego. We mm-hmm. drove cross country and we stopped in Dallas and we stopped here and we mm-hmm. stopped there to see these different places that were part of history. So mm-hmm. so I had that in my background, I guess. It's something that's there. I hope I passed it on to my child mm-hmm. because that's what I tried to do with her. Mm-hmm. So having an interest was important. When we didn't live in North Carolina when I came to college, we were up in Washington, D.C. So I decided after being here for 4 years that I was going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
So my senior year, I took North Carolina history with mm-hmm. Bill Powell because I felt it was important to know something about where I was going to live.
Because that's more or less the way you had grown
right,
up.
Right, right. Yeah. When I go to conferences and to other cities and states, I look through the phone book to read about the place where I am uh-huh. to, so that I know a little bit
right.
about it. So,
So that was kind of laid the groundwork for discovering these letters.
And then being a journalist and asking mm-hmm. those questions, you know, the who, what, when, where, why, and how, mm-hmm. in order to produce any story for someone, you've got to have all those answers. And each time I came across something I didn't understand, then I had to delve a little mm-hmm. a little deeper. So that's why such a deep bibliography and
yeah.
for the book, because of making certain that all the facts were correct and uh-huh. and that I did know what dresses were like back in those
right.
days. And
yeah,
that's the other thing about how coming across about how family life was so different. I mean, there were two things. One, the death of infants. This was fairly common. Your children didn't
siblings.
All survive.
Yes,
yeah, I mean,
yes,
it's throughout the history
died,
of the time.
And this was true also for her children.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and one of the stories that I tell in the book is about her daughter Dot gives birth and loses several children as well. And so my great uncle, who I've called the keeper of the family history, mm-hmm. his mother comes into the nursery one day and finds that he's covered up his little sister. And she says, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm making sure the angels don't take this one." And that
yeah.
was my grandmother he was covering up
yeah.
to make sure the angels didn't take, because another little sister had died the
uh-huh.
previous year.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so children were aware of this.
Yes.
Ella and General lost three children of
mm-hmm.
their six.
Mm-hmm.
And the first baby lived a day.
Mm-hmm.
The second baby lived 14 months.
Mm-hmm.
They had another child who lived under a year.
Right.
And then Mrs. Swain herself gave birth to six children,
mm-hmm.
and only three of them survived to adulthood. So
death was a very close part of family life, not like it is today.
I think that it was just something that happened, and
yes.
you accepted it, and you might be sad, but clearly you had to move on.
Mm-hmm.
Even Ella's letters note that, "I'm so sad over the death of my two boys, but I have to move on.
Right.
I can't be here in this place of mourning forever."
Something else I noted in reading through, and I don't know if I'm going to remember quite the details, but it seemed fairly common, well, at least instances in this book, of husband and wife living in different places. I mean, I think it was when her mother married David Swain.
Yes.
Didn't she like?
She
within,
didn't like Asheville, so she came
just
back
took
home
off
to Raleigh.
And, right. And she was, and then he would come and visit her in Raleigh.
And he finally, David Swain finally gave up his political ambitions
uh-huh.
because he wanted to be with his wife, and
uh-huh.
she didn't like Asheville. Well, you know, we like to think it's cold in Raleigh, but it's not near as cold as it is up in Asheville.
Right, the mountains.
The mountains, there's more snow, and she just didn't like it up there. I think that the same happened to Ella. She got to
right.
Freeport, Illinois. Now think of it, 120 miles northwest of Chicago,
mm-hmm.
right below the Wisconsin line.
It's pretty cold up
it
there.
It starts snowing up there in October sometimes,
uh-huh.
and my cousin reminded me when I mentioned coming to visit in March, she said, "Don't forget what might happen up here in March." So we've delayed the trip till June.
Right.
And I think that being young, you know, she was 23 when she gave birth to her first child.
Mm-hmm.
I think she thought that maybe the winter weather
had something to do with her
baby not living or her not having a good pregnancy or whatever, and she certainly wasn't going to let that happen again.
Right.
But I think she was homesick as well.
Yeah.
And there was a close-knit family, and I think I think she was very homesick.
It just it struck me as kind of unusual. And then I was thinking, well, maybe whether it was the times or was the fact that this was a certain level of society where the men were had, you know, political ambitions or, you know, career movements that would engender this type of separation. But it just seemed I got married, and, you know, what was it? A very short time later, she took off.
Yeah, he brought her back to, they got married in August. He brought her back to Chapel Hill in September the following year, and then she stayed through the spring.
Right.
I think he loved her enough that he knew how much she missed her family, and he wanted her to be happy.
Right.
Coupled with the fact that he was a busy man, he was postmaster, he was a lawyer, he was a newspaper man. Back then it was okay to do all those, and there was no conflict of interest. He was writing books, he was giving speeches, and probably for him, not having his family there allowed him to do all that. Not that he didn't want his family, but it at least made it easier.
Mm-hmm.
My husband said yesterday when he took our dog with him to go visit some family a couple hours away, he said, "You can have the whole house to yourself with neither of the two who drive you crazy to bother you." And then there I was in this empty, quiet house to relish it. So, you know, we all like to have those quiet moments sometimes.
Yeah. A room of one's own. Well, it's the, what do you tell your students? That's the, we're talking about journalism, and you have journalism in your background and your own career. What do you tell your students about a career today in journalism? And I'm thinking in terms of the fact that you keep hearing stories about the troubles that newspapers are in and keeping their readerships, and, you know, they're going out of business or they're diminishing the size. And what is journalism for a prospect for students today?
It's definitely in transition, whatever it is.
It is definitely in transition. And the one thing that I try to stress, and I just teach an introduction to journalism, so I try to teach them how to write a solid news story.
Mm-hmm.
Because no matter what medium of news or communication they go into, the ability to write a good, clean, clear news story is what's important.
Helps because in how they think as well.
Yes. From that, they can write just about anything. And so I really stress that whether you're going to be able to go into newspapers, and who knows, whether it's going to be online, whether it's going to be broadcast, whether they're going to be twittering, you know, their newscasts or just what, being able to succinctly get that information across is what's important. And so that's what we focus on in that class.
It's interesting in bringing in, when I think of journalism, I think of writing and I think of newspapers, maybe articles for magazines or something. But then there's the whole thing of broadcast journalism.
And there's the whole thing of blogging and the internet and everybody putting their thoughts up there. And
I really want somebody to come from out of the blue and teach me how to do a blog.
Google. Just go to Google and I set it up. So can you. But, you know, so there's going to be so many different avenues for them. And at some point, the explosion has got to stop, I think. And we'll start coming and we'll start coming back around to, OK, what are the most important modes of sharing information?
Right. Do your students say what it is they are hoping for from going into journalism?
Well, some of them want to be sports writers, and I tell them that that's an entirely different animal, but they still need to be able to write a good, solid news story to do that. There's some who want to go into advertising. They still have to be able to write a good, solid lead, even with advertising. They've got to get the message across in a sentence
or a phrase. Well, that would be a good place for, I can see, I never think of taking journalism as going into advertising, but certainly...
Yeah.
I mean, public relations is still a very viable animal, whereas even though journalism may not be, at least in traditional forms.
Yeah.
You know? And of course,
advertising, marketing.
Yeah, marketing. Mm-hmm.
You know. Well, that's in
but unfortunately,
type of society,
that's all.
It's a big thing.
Yeah, you know, it's pre-persuaded speech. You know?
Yeah.
It's it does. It you know, yeah. I mean. It, think all of that is gone under incredible changes. I mean, with the shift of the lack of public intellectuals, so there were still some back in the at the end of World War II and through the 50s, and then with the rise of television, we've lost that. And of course, the think tanks arose, but they don't represent intellectuals that speak to anybody but themselves.
Well, yeah, you don't generally hear too much about, unless you're specifically into that particular subject that they're in their tank about.
Yeah, they're gonna.
You don't hear what they're talking about.
No. Exactly.
And they don't know how to really communicate to an average person.
They don't want to.
But those who do want to communicate will be able to call on good writers.
Yes.
And so that's someone wanting to go into journalism, there's so many different ways that they can use those journalism skills. So that's what I try to impart to them.
Uh-huh. Well, before we get along, lose too much time, is there a section of the book that you'd like to read for us?
Well, I thought that I would read the wedding scene since we're in Chapel Hill and it happened here. And so what we know about the story so far is that Ella and General have met, whether her father wanted them to or not. He has wooed her, he has serenaded her, he has written her poetry, he has proposed, and she has told her parents that she's getting married. Mm-hmm. Now, did he go to President Swain and ask? We don't know that.
Uh-huh.
We don't know any of that, although I can't imagine that he did not.
Mm-hmm.
But he comes, he is mustered out, and he goes back to Illinois to get his own business affairs in order because he's going to have to work and find a place to live. And Ella is back in Chapel Hill preparing for her wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the wedding scene. The Swains sent few invitations for the wedding on August 23rd, 1865. Unlike Mrs. Spencer, many invitees sent their regrets. Invitations were spit upon in one or two houses, she wrote, adding that some family friends were very hot against Ellie. By all reports, Ella was a beautiful bride, entering the Swains' parlor at 8 o'clock that warm summer evening to the piano strains of favorite hymns. She wore a white gross-grained silk bodice and skirt that accented her dark shoulder-length hair and blue eyes. Attending the ceremony were former Governor Graham and his wife Susan. Both seemed to have been fond of the groom. Until his death in 1875, Governor Graham corresponded with Atkins, and his son, John W. Graham, was called on to defend the Union general against highly charged rumors that he had plundered silver and jewels from local homes. I regret very much that there can be found a person in North Carolina who will descend so low for the purpose of injuring the university, John Graham wrote President Swain about the maligning of his new son-in-law. It really seems to me sometimes that a portion of other Southern people have lost all common sense in regard to the nation. Also present were some UNC faculty and their families, as well as a number of gallant ex-Confederate soldiers, Union Army officers, a few close friends, and Mrs. Spencer's brother, Samuel Phillips, who had served as auditor for Governor Vance's Confederate government. Certainly sharing in the festivities would have been Ella's sister Anne, her brother Bunky and his wife and young daughter, her mother's sisters, Emma, Susan, Betsy, and Sophronia's husband, John. The Reverend Hubbard, who performed the ceremony, used the Episcopal service and asked the couple, would they love, comfort, and forsake all others so long as you both shall live? And they both said, I will. And then here's what happened. Even as Ella and General recited their vows, anger about the marriage was not subdued. For 3 long hours that evening, university students tolled the campus bells in protest and hung General Atkins and President Swain in effigy from the bell tower of Old South, the university's main building. The bell ring did not interrupt the ceremony. The marriage was sealed when General Smith Atkins placed on Ella Swain's left hand the wedding ring, a filigree band topped with a miniature crown of dozens of tiny, shiny diamonds. A grand supper followed, despite food shortages caused by the war and its aftermath. Guests dined on some of the Swains' favorite dishes, turkey salad, scalloped oysters, greens, and summer fruits. It was a wedding cake, large and handsomely decorated, Mrs. Spencer wrote, that truly stood out in the lavish feast. A gift from the freedmen, former slaves who had been liberated after the Civil War, the cake was given to their deliverer and liberator, in Mrs. Spencer's words. Reviled by some, the general was a hero to others. Emblematic of the rapidly changing world in which they were living, the guests ate the cake baked by these newly freed slaves as the loud protest continued from Old South.
Wow. What a scene. You know, it makes you think, they wonder, maybe somebody will want to make a movie out of this, because I could see it being
maybe
a movie.
Maybe so. That would be very nice indeed.
And it would be interesting to see Franklin Street as that muddy old trail it used to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right up through the 20th century, folks. Mm-hmm. Early 20th century. Mm-hmm. It was still much a village than a town.
Well, my daughter graduated in film studies from UNC Wilmington and has been working in the film industry and is starting to make some connections. So we're hoping that one of those connections will lead us into a movie. It has a lot of drama
because of all the intricacies, particularly to show something that was actually nuanced, to show that there were lots of different very human relationships on both sides, and that was never simply one side against the other with well-drawn lines.
Right, yes.
And that would be something that would definitely be good for remembering.
Undaunted Heart, the true story of a Southern belle and a Yankee general.
See, do we have time to usually we ask our guests to recommend three books.
Well, you asked me about that, and I thought long and hard, and I'm not so sure that these are the books that other folks would suggest. But when I was in fifth grade, my English teacher's mother was a children's author. Her name was Natalie Savage Carlson, and she wrote a book called The Family Under the Bridge. And it is still in print.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's good for children to learn about homelessness. No, it's about a family that was homeless.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And even though it was written back in the 1960s, it still has a place, I think, for children. And it's actually on a couple of the reading lists throughout the United States for children to learn about homelessness. And because it was written by my teacher's mother, you know, it always had a place in my heart. But in looking at it from that perspective of homelessness, I think it's a good one. Reynolds Price, A Whole New Life, that he wrote after he had his surgery for his cancer. If that doesn't put people in a different frame of mind, I don't know what will.
Mm-hmm. No, he's an incredible writer.
Mm-hmm. And so that one, to me, is one that I recommend to people if they're going through a difficult time. And then I thought about all the other authors who I love, Elise Smith, Helen McGinnis, Howard Fast, all these authors. But one that has stayed with me for years and years and has fashioned the fact that I took French in school and that on our trip to Europe, when we finally get to take it, we're going to visit Mont Saint-Michel, was a book called The Mystery of Mont Saint-Michel. It triggered my interest in history for that monument, written by Michael Ruse, and then it was translated into English. It was a young person's book, a young adult book. But
Michael Ruse?
R-O-U-Z-E, French.
Okay.
So I guess maybe Michel Ruse.
Okay.
And it was one that triggered my interest more in the history of France and in what that part of France was like. And again, I guess that just comes into play with my interest in history. But for me, those are three books that have had a place in my heart for a long, long time.
It's in reference to the first one, The Family Under the Bridge. I read something in the paper, and I'm pretty sure that it was accurate, that the new American Doll, the American Girl Doll series. The new one is a homeless girl.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, it's something that's important
for kids
to know.
That's incredible considering how prim and proper they've been in the past.
It's also the one who was writing this article was the strangeness of people paying $100 for a doll about a homeless person, and maybe they would be better off making a contribution to the local shelter.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Or do both.
Yeah.
The people who buy those things, they usually could afford both. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Talking about the book, and I just thoroughly enjoyed it. And everybody, again, it's Undaunted Heart, The True Story of a Southern Belle and a Yankee General by Susie Barilli.
Barilli.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to close, unfortunately. This is WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carborough.